The late rapper extraordinaire Mac Miller once said, "It is what it is till it ain't." And this week's fish fry, my friends, is what it is until it's over. Well, hello, everyone. Welcome to another absolutely fabulous, if I do say so myself, episode of Amelia's Weekly Fish Fry, brought to you by EEJournal.com and hosted by yours truly, Amelia Dalton. So why the Mac Miller quote? Other than it's part of my newest tattoo. Yeah, no lie. No, because today we're talking about drawing that OEM line in the sand. We will not spend our time and resources beyond this point. And then that point moves. And then there's another big order and that line moves again and again. And at some point, sustainment becomes a slog. If it doesn't keep you moving forward, it only holds you back. Please welcome Shiku Thompson and Ethan Plotkin from GDCA. We're talking about sustainment, the 80-20 rule, and why you get what you measure, but you don't always measure what you get. Let's go.
Thank you so much for joining me, Ethan. Thank you so much for joining me, Shiku.
Thanks for having me, Amelia.
Thank you, Amelia. Great to be here.
Okay, so first off, you wrote a blog recently entitled Blinded by the Top Line, where you mentioned that you can get what you measure, but you also don't always measure what you get. So tell me what you mean by that.
Well, thanks for mentioning that blog. That was a really fun one to write. What I meant by that was OEMs are often really top-line focused, and a lot of times when it comes to ongoing demand for dwindling products that have been end-of-lifed because they're no longer profitable, OEMs find it really hard to resist quoting and trying to fulfill ad hoc orders for these old products, mainly because they really are top-line driven. They need to make revenue objectives. So that's the dynamic that we find ourselves in. What happens, I think, a lot of times, and what I meant by the you get what you measure, but you don't always measure what you get, is that OEMs, when they pursue the revenue from old products, they do get the revenue on the top line, but there are a lot of hidden costs associated with quoting and fulfilling these products, right? For example, the overhead costs alone of delivering the bottom 1% of sales revenue. These are the bottom of the barrel products. The overhead cost of that is 25%, right? And that's kind of based on the whole 80-20 principle. So that's what I mean. There's a lot of costs that they incur that they're not measuring at all. And so it really skews their perception of how valuable these orders are because they are only looking at revenue.
Okay, so at this year's Embedded Tech Trends show, you had a session called Product Pruning to Increase Revenue and Profitability. So let's talk about the details of that. What exactly do you mean by pruning?
Well, what I mean by pruning is it's a lot more than just end-of-lifing products that have become hard to manufacture. What product pruning is really all about is, first, enabling OEMs the process and the information to pinpoint exactly where demand for old products starts becoming erratic, and then also to understand when the sustainment efforts of managing the obsolescence of these old products starts really dragging down the individual profitability of a product's bottom line. And that, I think, those indirect labor costs are exactly what I was talking about when I said sometimes you get a lot of things that you don't actually measure. So the other half of product pruning is that OEMs, not only do they want to cut products that are no longer profitable, which is kind of standard industry practice nowadays, what they also need are processes in place to keep them from getting sucked back into resurrecting dead old products for chasing top line revenue. So it also gives them an opportunity or a way to dispose of those products while still giving them the information to be confident that they're not leaving future revenue and value on the table.
All right. So a big issue these days, I'm sure you will agree, in EE involves the supply chain and especially trust in our supply chain. Give me your thoughts on that.
Well, you know, this is very interesting. I mean, GDCA, from a supply chain perspective, we manufacture everything onshore with authentic components in the United States. However, a lot of the products that we inherit or transfer from OEMs that have been end-of-lifed were actually originally manufactured offshore in low-cost centers. So in a sense, we're actually putting trust into the supply chain. So that's kind of fun. But I think when it comes to trusted supply chain, as part of my night job, right? Yeah. My day job is sustainment. My night job is I'm a member of the NDIA, National Defense Industries Association, and I'm the chair of the Supply Chain Network Committee. And supply chain assurance in that NDIA forum is closely tied with cybersecurity and supply chain risk management. And what I am finding is that generally a lot of the general discourse in the defense industry is really focused around information technology, IT. However, not a lot of discussion or attention has been given to operational technology, the stuff that embedded systems use. So that conversation needs to be expanded. And I see some really positive things happening out of SAE and their G32 committee, which is basically putting together a standard for cybersecurity for cyber physical systems or things that are embedded systems that fly and drive and actually are, you know, wearable medical devices.
All right, Chico. So let's throw this last question at you. Now, you guys recently announced a partnership with Radisys to indefinitely extend the life of legacy products. So indefinitely, that's a strong term. Tell me about that.
Well, I think Radisys has always been geared towards their customers and providing them the products that they need for as long as possible. But I think with their new shift and the direction that they're looking to move into, be more disruptive in the industry, being able to transfer products to GDCA is allowing them to focus on their core products and really get new introductions out the door. So it's really great for us because it allows us to continue to do what we do really well, which is support old legacy boards. And it allows them to be able to free up resources that they need right now to make that shift in position.
All right, Ethan, it's time for your off-the-cuff question. I'm throwing a new one at you. You're going to be my guinea pig for this question. If you had to have dinner with one person in the world tonight, living or dead, actually, anyone, who would it be?
Well, I think, sadly, with the recent news, I think it'd have to be Kobe Bryant. I've been a Warriors fan for years, and while I hated playing Kobe, we never hated Kobe. Right. And even when he was past his prime, he could walk on in the last 2 minutes and put up a game winner. And it really, really frosted us constantly. But you got to respect that. So given the existing news, I would totally buy a Kobe dinner.
Good answer. And I did not like playing against him either as a Portland Trailblazers fan. Okay. Well, Ethan, I think that's all I have time for today. Thank you so much for joining me, as always.
Thank you, Amelia. Always a pleasure.
Just like you can't pick revenue out of thin air, I mean, that'd be nice though, wouldn't it? You can't drink thin air, right? I mean, sure, we've all opened our mouths in the rain at some point, but what about drinking humidity? Oh yes, that's what we're talking about in this week's News You May Have Missed, MOF edition. A recent breakthrough at Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab, or APL, has put a whole new way to collect drinking water on the map, or in the sky, as the case may be. So, what is that MOF business all about? Let me introduce you to Metal Organic Framework, which lies at the heart of this new research at Johns Hopkins APL. This Metal Organic Framework is pretty cool. So, most importantly, MOF has the highest surface area of any known material. Yeah, so if you were to lay out just 1 gram of metal organic framework, you could cover an entire football field. Yeah, that's American football. I'm not sure the stats for a soccer stadium. Anyway, so it's this grandiose surface area that is key to its unique ability to absorb water vapor and collect it in a liquid form. So this team from Johns Hopkins, APL, studied 10 different types of MOFs, a variety of different environmental conditions, including temperature and humidity, to see how these different conditions affected their ability to absorb water vapor. And what they found blew other research studies along these lines right out of the water. Literally. So there have been studies along these lines for a couple years now. In 2018 and in 2019, the University of Berkeley worked on a similar method for collecting humidity using MOFs, but their results pale in comparison. This team from Johns Hopkins, APL, managed to collect 8.66 liters, or 2.3 gallons, of water per day per kilogram of MOF, compared to Berkeley's 1.3 liters per day per kilogram in last year's study. Wow. Ziyong Jia, co-lead author of this study, puts it like this. This will help us deepen our understanding of these materials and guide the discovery of next-generation water harvesting methods. But this team from Johns Hopkins APL isn't done yet. They're continuing to look at other types of MOFs, how they can be combined and configured, and how they could implement this new humidity collection system in drier areas of the world, where water collection is at a premium. Super cool stuff, right? So if you want any further information about this study, I've included a couple links below the player on this week's Fish Frying page on eejournal.com, including a video of it in action and a white paper called Reversible Atmospheric Water Harvesting Using Metal Organic Frameworks. Hey, have you checked out EE Journal on social media yet? Well, you should! You can find us at facebook.com/EEJournal. If you're into Twitter, you can monitor our tweets at EEJournalTFM. And don't forget, if you want to follow my personal Twitter account, check out AmeliaD1978. And hey, if LinkedIn is more your thing, well, sure, you can follow us on LinkedIn as well. And we have a YouTube channel, youtube.com/EEJournal. Folks, it is chock full of all kinds of super cool techie videos, including our very popular Chalk Talk webcast series hosted by you know who. And by clicking the links below the player on this week's Fish Frying page, you can check out the Fish Fry archive or subscribe to Fish Fry via the iTunes Store. And remember, if you want any further information about the stories covered in today's show, just head on over to eejournal.com and look for this week's Fish Frying page. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. If you know of any cool new technology, any fun EE conference coming up that I absolutely should attend, or even the best geeky hotspot in your city, I love that stuff, shoot me a line at amelia@eejournal.com or post a comment on our forums on EE Journal. For the week of February 7th, 2020, I'm Amelia Dalton, and you've been fried.